I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about a time in America that changed lives and altered American history. This summer marks the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, the 10-week crusade to challenge and break the barriers imposed by legal segregation in Mississippi. We will talk about what happened during that crucial summer and how those days changed this country. My guests will be Dr. Thomas Brown, a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and John Dittmer, DePaul University History Professor Emeritus and the author of Local People, The Struggle for Civil Rights in Mississippi. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about Freedom Summer. We're in the 50th anniversary of that crucial period in American history when many people tried to challenge the barriers imposed by segregation in the Deep South, specifically in Mississippi. We're going to be talking about what happened during that period and what it meant, how it changed the country. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guests are intimate with that period. They know it well. I have with me Dr. Thomas Brown, who is a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and historian John Dittmer is professor emeritus from DePaul University and is the author of Local People, The Struggle for Civil Rights in Mississippi. Welcome to both of you.
Good to be here.
Good to be here. Thank you.
It's good to have you here. Well, I'm going to start first. Dr. Brown, you obviously, you have intimate knowledge. You were there, right?
Correct.
Okay. I was there. Tell me a little bit about the path that led you there.
My dad, who's Dr. Andrew J. Brown, of course, was in the civil rights era of the 50s and 60s, and I lived in that household. Many times when Dr. King, Abernathy, a host of other guys who would come to the house because they couldn't stay in hotels in Indianapolis in the late 50s and early 60s, and here I am, a youngster. King first visited us in 56, and Abernathy, when his house, they stayed at the house. So consequently, I'm in that environment, that atmosphere, listening to them. And these were young men. Just imagine. I look at myself now, 70 plus, and think about them. They were, in fact, 25, 26 years old. But they were in the movement. My dad was in the movement. And my dad, having coming out of the military and segregated military, was committed to social change. So I learned this. So in 1961, I was in Bishop College in Marshall, Texas. And in 1960, and for some reason, I decided I wanted to join SNCC. So I came back to Indianapolis, told my dad I'm going to drop out of college. He said, I understand my mother had a
not
fit.
So much.
Oh,
yeah,
no, not so by the stretch in your imagination. And so I joined SNCC, and I went into Atlanta and got my first assignment was to go into Selma. Now, this is in 62. People did not understand what was going on in 62 in Selma, and I was assigned to go into Selma to basically organize young people and get started the idea of registering to vote. However, I got promoted real quick, and they told me back in Atlanta, Brown, we want you to cover all the colleges, black colleges in Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, North and South Carolina, and to also follow up on getting students involved in the movement because we needed students, and then we also worked on high school students because many parents and adults did not want, we couldn't get them to what you would say demonstrate. And so that was my assignment. So I was covering.
Now, why did you choose SNCC? You know, there were other options. ways you could get involved with Dr. King's group, for example, Southern Christian Leadership?
Probably because of the fact that my dad and them were too close. I did not need to be monitored because they'll be watching out Andrew J. Brown's son. And I like SNCC because SNCC had had more of what I would call movement.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, SCLC had the movement, and it was around a lot of churchy things. SNCC was about getting into the community, places such as Mississippi. We started the Freedom Schools early. We were also doing what we call the VEP program, what's called Voter Education Project, which was funded.
Well, and what I'm fascinated, and I want us to talk about this a little later, is that there were rivalries between those groups, and since you kind of had a foot in both camps, I'm wondering to some degree.
I can tell you why it was a rivalry.
Okay, please.
SCLC was a rivalry to SNCC because they got all of the media attention. The intense media attention and the fundraising initiatives were more...
Because of Dr. King.
Of Dr. King. And many times Dr. King would come into an area where we had been working, and then all of the attention, that happened in Selma. That happened in Georgia, in Southwest Georgia. We take the blunt. We take the killings and the beatings. Then SCLC would come in and have the big finale, mm-hmm. and then leave. And then we were
and
still
there. Collect the checks. Yeah,
that's it. Okay, you want to know? That's it. That's the bottom line.
Good to know the not-for-profit world worked the same way 50 years ago too.
Thank you,
John. Obviously. Dr. Brown's got an intimate experience and was on the ground there. Could you give me a somewhat larger perspective here about why Freedom Summer was as important as it was, what it meant in the long flow of American history?
Well, I think probably the place to start is why there was a Freedom Summer.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for this was SNCC and other civil rights organizations under the Council of Federated Organizations, or COFO. That was the umbrella agency of all the organizations working in Mississippi, had been active since SNCC went into Macomb in 1961. And what was happening was that white Mississippi was doing everything in its power to destroy the movement. Not only with voter registration, people being turned down, but there were beatings, there were killings. And the rest of the country didn't seem to be paying attention, particularly the Kennedy administration. One of the myths about the civil rights movement was that John Kennedy was a great champion of the civil rights movement. He had to be moved, and when he was assassinated, tragically, why Lyndon Johnson came along, and both of them had basically the same position, that they weren't going to intervene in the affairs of southern states. They called that policy federalism. Only in the case of some place where the southern states could not maintain law and order, as in the integration of James Meredith back mm-hmm. in 62, would they become involved. So what was happening was that SNCC and other organizations and local people were doing what they could in Mississippi, but that they were being wiped out. And so the idea was that we're going to have to attract attention. What better way to do that than to invite the sons and daughters of prominent people, congressmen, lawyers, doctors, down to Mississippi for a summer, focus the national spotlight on the state, and then hopefully why the government would take an interest and enforce the Constitution in the Magnolia State.
We are talking about the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. John, question, why Mississippi? I mean, why, none of the southern states was particularly enlightened on matters of racial justice at the time. Why Mississippi?
Roy Wilkins of the NAACP once put it in a very short sentence. He says, Mississippi is the worst state. That other states, Alabama certainly, and parts of Georgia, but Mississippi was really a frontier state. It was settled late. There was no enlightened press. The whites in Mississippi either had to be quiet, join the Citizens Council, or leave the state. And this was one of the things that attracted the young SNCC workers. They wanted to go into the place where it was considered to be the worst and do something there. The NAACP nationally didn't want to get involved in Mississippi because they were thinking, well, we'll have a strategy where we'll get the easier states, pick them off, and then go into Mississippi. But SNCC was there right away, and they found a lot of local people. And what SNCC would do, they would go in and they would not, they would organize people who were farmers, sharecroppers, maids, yardmen, people who had not been leaders in their community, and they would develop this leadership. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the best example of that is Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, a sharecropper who was thrown off her plantation for trying to register and ended up becoming the symbol of the black freedom struggle in Mississippi.
Dr. Brown, since you were down there, you know, first, that perception that John was talking about, that was Mississippi, I mean, among those of you who were doing the work, and obviously you said you started out in Selma and then began to develop responsibilities for Georgia and Mississippi and Alabama. Was Mississippi, in fact, the worst?
I can appreciate John. John just called out some names that just struck a chord. When he said Macomb, Mississippi, see, I knew Jimmy Travis down there. I knew Lafayette Cerny. Mm. And those are the guys in Macomb and that area. He's dead. He's dead on it. There's a couple other people. Remember Mega Evers. See, that Mega Evers was at my dad's house and stayed with us 3 weeks before he went back. That then his wife called and told my I answered the phone and she said, Tommy, I need to speak with your daddy. They have killed Megger. I said, huh? And those kind of situations. Mm-hmm. So Mississippi, my dad was from Mississippi, Duncan, Mississippi, and dad would never go back home. He wouldn't even drive through Mississippi. He'd fly over Mississippi. Bob Moses and those guys really, it's good to sit with the historian who knows how to organize this stuff. Mine is like, I was all over the place. But when he called out Macomb and when he said what he said about it being tough, he's not lying. But one place I hated to go to was Yazoo City. Woo! I'd go into Yazoo and I make it a point to get out before the sun go down because you're a dead person. I saw many, many of those trucks with guns in the back, cross the rack, blow you out of there. They blow you away. So I had a respect for Mississippi. I'd roll in there, hit the colleges, do what I got to do, run over to Alabama. I'd get out of Meridian, come straight into Selma. Out of Selma, I'd try to head to Atlanta. And at some points, Atlanta was very hot. So so it was all going on.
Well, let me stick with that. For a second, I mean, I would think you had to be scared. How did you deal with the fear? I mean, we tend to forget, and one of the things about talking about the past is that because the outcomes are kind of known, you take away a lot of the tension, and that people often think that, you know, what did happen inevitably had to happen, and that's not the case, that it was, all possibilities were alive then, including the possibility that you don't get out of Yazoo City safe or whatever. How did you deal with being afraid?
The fear factor that we worked around was also based on our fellowship. The freedom songs, we would get together and do a lot of freedom songs and chants together before we hit any place. Even when we were driving those little cars, we had the Plymouths, the white Plymouths with the that we drove, you would start singing. The freedom songs had a real relevance. Freedom songs, and that's one of the missing.
Such as, can you remember one of them?
This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Old freedom, old freedom. Then the freedom singers came up with a song called Dogs, Dogs, Dogs. And I think you remember that. And
Black Dog and a White Dog.
Black Dog and a White Dog. James Bevel and all of those with SCLC. We did have a camaraderie on the lower sector. With SCLC, and we can never leave CORE out. Congress on the Racial can't not leave them out. They were tough.
Well, and I guess then
freedom songs kept us going. Freedom songs and prayer.
Okay.
Really serious prayer. And the teachings of nonviolence. We had to embrace, to the best of our ability, the understanding of what love is, and love meant you had to be prepared to die. That was it.
And what was the moment when you were down there that you were the most scared? Can you remember one?
Yeah. The one I was most scared was after Kennedy got killed. That was, we knew we were in trouble. That was one of the moments. And the other moment was when the girls got killed in Birmingham, which we call Bummingham.
Uh-huh.
Those were terrifying moments. Now, the Selma march across the bridge, I feared for the people on the bridge.
We are talking about Freedom Summer here on No Limits. My guests are Dr. Thomas Brown, who is a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and historian John Dittmer, who is the author of Local People, The Struggle for Civil Rights in Mississippi. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Again, I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about Freedom Summer. It's the 50th anniversary of that epic time in American history. My guests are Dr. Thomas Brown, who is a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who was down there during the summer, and historian John Dittmer, professor emeritus of history from DePauw and is the author of Local People, The Struggle for Civil Rights in Mississippi. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Charles, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. How about you?
I'm just fine. I called in. I've listened to your show, and I've called in before. But my friend, and actually I have to say, even now listening to what he said, he was around a man who I call my hero, Dr. King, but I'm listening to this man who I have been around and touched, Dr. Brown there, and he is more extraordinary than I thought he was. This is an extraordinary man, the courage that it took. I watched those things. I'm a veteran. I watched those things, and I'm kind of going, wow, it took a lot of gonads to go there and stand in the face of hatred and animosity and keep pursuing, and people lost their lives. And this man is an extraordinary man. He's more extraordinary than I thought he was, and I'm glad to reckon him as a friend of mine, and I'm glad that I've been able to glean a little bit of the wisdom that he has, because I've been kind of playing it off and going, no, this guy actually made it able for me and my family to live in a better world, all of us. It's truly amazing. I'm amazed, and he knows me. He knows that
I do.
I'm excited about this. This is he's more amazing than I thought he was. That's all I have to say.
Well, thank you very much for the call, Charles, and I think you probably made Dr. Brown's day.
Thank
as well.
You.
Thanks very much for the call. Well, let's talk a little bit about, you know, we've talked about how scary it was, and we've mentioned, you know, there's several, but there were people who lost their lives during Freedom Summer itself.
Direct,
right, Dr. Brown?
I had to go to Oxford, Oxford, Ohio, where Miami College was. My assignment was to be there, too. Mickey, the Schwaner, and all of those guys and gals were there, and we were doing the training, getting them prepared to go into Mississippi. And Bob Moses, Stokely, I could name them all. We were getting them prepared, particularly those coming out of New York, coming out of Jersey, coming out of that East Coast. Be prepared. Stick together and keep the information. When Goodman Schwaner started, we knew, because we knew exactly the cars. We had the list of cars and everything. When they went, we knew within something like, I'd say, 9 or 10 hours, we weren't getting, because we had the radio in the car. So that's when we had our the cars, and they didn't get back, and we knew they had hit. We knew then it was ugly.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we didn't try to play the media thing, because media could get you killed as well as media could help you if it got to the wrong hands. So no, that was one of the many incidences, And the story still is not told, but when they started looking for those bodies, how many bodies of ex-students were found in the various rivers through class rings?
Yeah, they found another like 8 bodies, right? Something like that, didn't John Dittmer?
Well, it was the summer was the most violent in Mississippi since the end of Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. There were at least 6 racial murders. Those are the bodies that have been recovered. 35 shooting incidents. 65 homes and other buildings were bombed, including 35 churches. 1,000 movement people were arrested, and 80 activists suffered beatings. This was unprecedented in the country at that time. And because it was in the first week of the summer project that the 3 civil rights workers, Andrew Goodman, James Chaney, and Mickey Schwerner, disappeared. Their mm-hmm. bodies were not found until later in the summer. But that cast a pall over the entire project. And that story went out around the world. So mm-hmm. if it was... One of the purposes was to attract attention. Well, not this way, but it succeeded because the whole country was looking at Mississippi in the weeks that followed.
And, Dr. Brown, I got to ask. I mean, those 3 guys, you know, when they don't show up, that, as you said, not a good outcome. And in fact, you probably realized they were dead.
Yeah.
I mean, what does that? Were there people who wanted to leave at that point and said because as you know, as John has just said, it happened in the first week.
Mm-hmm. The thing is, what happened from my experience was it intensified. I've got the good historian here. I've got to sit down and talk to him, help me put this conceptualized.
Well, I think he wants to talk to you, too.
So. No, it intensified. Here we had the 1,000 coming in. You had more that wanted to come in. Our challenge was being able to control. See, we had to teach nonviolence. Yeah. We had to keep things in order. We had to be aware that the best word I can use in 21st century is have infiltrators coming in to rock and shake up things. And we had to cover our backs. Mm-hmm. And a lot of success in handling the movement and being in the movement was to cultivate and develop your intuitive skills. Intuitive skills, mm-hmm. working in the South, you had to kind of read what was going to happen before it happens. It was like knowing where to go, and when not to go on behalf of the people. And many of our people in Mississippi and other states put their lives on the line. That's not the story that's been told. Mm-hmm. Fannie Lou Hamer, when we were putting the Freedom Democratic Party together, mm-hmm. that's when it got really ugly.
Yeah.
And the people that really suffered, and we had to realize that as SNCC, it was the people who lived in those cities. I mean, and that story never gets told.
And that was one of the concerns, obviously, about the movement at that time, mm-hmm. is that, you know, that, and it was one of the things that activists were attacked as outside agitators.
You're an outside agitator.
Yeah, that you come in and
start on trouble.
Start trouble, and that it's really the problem isn't segregation.
And our white brothers and sisters were saying the same thing. You come in and upset our colored folk. That was, you know, don't our color folk. The word black wasn't used.
Well, and they used the possessive, too, color, which is interesting.
Our color folk.
Our color, yeah. So talk to me a little bit about how they trained you to the discipline of nonviolence, because I would think if you're in a situation where your life is actually being threatened like that and you're living under that kind of threat, I mean, fight or flight is kind of a natural reaction. You're going to do one of 2 things. And really what this said, the training said, is do neither.
Right. The training program, I was kind of fortunate in the fact that my dad made me read all of Dr. King's books before I started on my own journey about nonviolence and anything that was written. My dad had me reading it, and he's an ex-veteran, mm-hmm. and he said, I'm working on my nonviolence, but I'll work on yours. So I had a little pre. So when I got into the movement, I'll tell you who did do a lot of work with me, Bernard Lafayette. Mm-hmm. He was a trainer. You did your own reading, and I did some stuff under James Bevel. Mm-hmm. James Bevel was good at it in understanding nonviolence as a strategy. Mm-hmm. As a strategy. Being prepared, you're going to get beat. John Lewis, I work with John Lewis. Mm-hmm. I used to say, John, you just love to be beat on. I mean, you mm-hmm. just, that was a joke we had because he went to jail 30-some times.
And, yeah.
But we had inner circles that constantly reinforce ourselves in remaining to stay nonviolent. Even Stokely would say, Tom, we know you got something going on because we don't think you really ought not nonviolent. They still work on me. But it was how you set your mind. You knew this was the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you always accepted the time to die. You had to prepare to die. Because the greatest hurt was and harm, you see, was what's happening to the other people. And they couldn't they trusted us.
Yeah.
And the children, that's when you saw fear was not in the children. When we put them on the lines, it reminds me of what happened in South Africa. It was children that were doing the demonstration.
Well, they turned it in Birmingham was really, basically, you turned the children out and forced Birmingham to try to fill the jails.
Yeah. And Birmingham wasn't no play PC when they started doing those demonstrations.
No. We are talking about Freedom Summer. It's the 50th anniversary here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. George, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure, I'm sure.
It is indeed.
I had a scary experience. I am blind, and I went to learn to travel with a cane in Little Rock, Arkansas. And you were assigned different places to go, like, I don't know, Merle Norman's Beauty Shop or whatever. And you could go any place, and they would assign us things. And if we didn't want to go there, we didn't have to. And I'm a gregarious musician.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted me to go to one of the assignments was go to Little Rock, North Little Rock, Arkansas. So the rule was if anybody is at the street corner, ask them to help you across.
Mm-hmm.
And there were these three adorable sounding black girls, colored girls, that you hardly know what to call people anymore, but they were just adorable. And I said, would you help me across the street? And they very pleasantly said, yes, they would. And about a half a block later, I hear this pound, 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 pound. And this guy walks up to me and he says, do you want me to beat those girls up? And I said, well, why? He says, well, you crossed the street, and he used the N-word, only he finished it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And I said, please don't. They were just helping me. And, I mean, if you talk about scared, and I was scared for them, and I'm thinking, what is wrong with this man?
What year was this, sir?
That was 1963.
Oh, boy. So same time while all of this was going on. Or not quite. Yeah. It was the year before, 1963.
Yeah.
Wow. Well,
and like it gives me goosebumps just remembering it. They were just, I never meet a stranger, and they just sounded, really adorable. They were probably 15, 16.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, good Lord, I hope he doesn't do anything to them.
Yeah.
And I guess he didn't.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that story. It puts into perspective what we were dealing with at the time. Thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome. And they had, by the way, separate schools for blind people, that were black or white. And the whited people, yeah, was in Little Rock. And then the other ones are in Pine Bluff.
Pine Bluff.
And
mm-hmm.
I went to Pine Bluff and visited that school as well.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for the call.
You're
welcome. Thank you. Well,
I remember Pine Bluff.
And
Little Rock.
Yeah, well, and I guess what I would ask here, Dr. Brown, I mean, you hear that, and you hear about that level of anger and animosity. I've asked you about the fear, but I would think, among other things, just living in that constant state of tension and wariness. I mean, you talked about how you knew you had to get out of Yazoo City before the sun went down and that, you had kind of mileposts along the way that you knew you had to get to safety and to always have to be thinking in those terms. How did you cope with the stress?
Well, you had with that. That's what I, when we interview folks, that's a good question. That's a question you have to really wrestle with. We hit battle fatigue. Mm-hmm. I got out of the movement around 66 because you started switching. You started switching where you become angry. You become angry. It could be like a little post-traumatic
stress.
Not a disorder, stress problem.
Yeah.
So you back out and you come back and you go back into school. You do those things. How we cope at that particular time, I think, is we socialized. We fed back on each other. But then I did notice all of us in the movement tended to have our quiet time. That's what helped me, with the Charles Crenshaw who called in. Mm-hmm. That's what helped me to end up going to India in the 70s and on through the 80s and picking up the whole idea of nonviolence, love, and the ability to handle yoga. Mm-hmm. And that was training and conditioning your mind to handle the externals. So during those 3-4 years that I was, I was just blessed or fortunate, and I made it through. There were some who really lost it. A couple of friends of mine out of the Mississippi area were going to blow up. I won't call names to blow up some of the artifacts in Washington D.C. and the dynamite in the car blew up and killed them.
Well, and they had different, like you talked about Bob Moses who changed his name at one point because he wasn't comfortable with the kind of attention that was not in terms of
he's just a genius
being afraid, but more, you know, the level of adulation that he didn't want to make it a cult of personality. So I guess, John, you know, we talked a little bit about the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. Could we talk about that, too, and talk a little bit about what the goals were here for this effort?
Yeah, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party was part of Freedom Summer. The idea was to organize a separate party that would be open to all, but it would be predominantly black, and they would challenge the regular party at the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City. The segregated party, blacks could not participate. So they did this. They organized the party. They went to Atlantic City, and it became the story of the convention. Lyndon Johnson was president. There was no question he was going to be nominated, but it was the Freedom Democrats' challenge. It was Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer saying, if the Freedom Party isn't seated now, I question America, and that was played in prime time at night. The result was that there was a so-called compromise that would have given the Freedom Democratic Party 2 seats at large, and they named the people to take them. And that the white regular party would be seated if they promised to support the president. Well, the Freedom Democrats met, and as Mrs. Hamer said, we didn't come all this way for no 2 seats because all of us is tired. But what happened at that convention? It was considered to be a defeat at the time, but the Democratic Party pledged that they would, from that point on, open up the party and there would be no more discrimination. And on inaugural day in 2008, Bob Moses went on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, and he said, you can draw a straight line from the challenge of the Freedom Democratic Party in 1964 to the nomination of a black man for president in 2008. So it was a very important part of the summer, and one that I think needs to have more attention paid to it.
What were the results? I mean, in terms of how it shaped this country, you know, the long term, they went there basically to register voters and to try to break. But the impact was far more far reaching than that.
The impact of Freedom Summer?
Yes.
I have a quote.
You can get us started here.
Yeah, well, I just have a quote here from Stokely Carmichael, who was in Mississippi the whole time. He said it was the turning point for the whole generation of us. It was certainly the boldest, most dramatic and traumatic single event of the entire movement. It certainly had the most far-reaching effect. For national party politics, for that activist college generation, for the state of Mississippi and the movement there, after the summer, none of those would be the same.
We are talking about the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer here on No Limits. My guests are Dr. Thomas Brown, who was a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and historian John Dittmer, who's written the book Local People, The Struggle for Civil Rights in Mississippi. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, that 10-week period in Mississippi that changed a lot of lives and altered the course of American history. My guests are Dr. Thomas Brown, who was a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, was down there at the time, and historian John Dittmer, who's professor emeritus from DePauw and the author of Local People, The Struggle for Civil Rights in Mississippi. If you would like to join the conversation, you can shoot us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. We've gotten an email question from a listener named John. Says, hello, my name is John, and I am an incoming freshman at Franklin College. Glad to have you on board, John. My question for Dr. Brown is, with people of color still disproportionately imprisoned for crimes that are as often committed by white peers, what do you think can be done to continue the fight for social justice in the prison industrial complex?
That's to me?
That's to you. Yeah, he wants you to solve a big problem.
That sounds like a profound student there. I used to teach in the university. It just took off for a year. So I answer that question. One of the greatest things is I'm sitting here next to a brother who's a historian. A lot of this would be solved if we do more teaching of history, the history. A lot of two or three generations behind that are behind me now don't have a clue. Mm-hmm. They do not have a clue, and we need – I have a charter school, the Andrew J. Brown Chartered Academy, and the most important thing is we've got to teach more history. Their parents don't know the history, and their grandparents don't know the history. So teaching education – in regard to the historical significance and contributions of all people and teaching the history of the movement would minimize some of the, what we call that, taking them right to the prisons. Because the lack of history forces you to do what? Repeat.
And one of the things I'd like to ask while we're on this, I mean, what, John, and I'm going to ask you first, but I think both of you to weigh in, what is the biggest misperception about either Freedom Summer or the civil rights movement?
Well, it's interesting that as more time passes, why people have a different impression of what was going on back then. For example, some conservatives have used Dr. King's statement that a person should be judged not on the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. To me, to say that King was not in favor of affirmative action or any of these things, which is not the case at all. Everybody has their own history, and I think that's why it's important to listen to people like Dr. Brown and others. When I was teaching at DePauw, we would have civil rights activists come into the class so our students could get to know them and ask them questions. But the problem is that history is becoming homogenized, and the narrative is that all these bad things were happening in the South, and then these white folks came down in Freedom Summer, and they passed civil rights laws, and everything is fine now.
Yeah,
that's one of the things that the
which
movement
was sort of the spirit of John's question too.
That movement activists really take umbrage about because they went through a lot more on their own back then. Mm-hmm. And things are not fine now. They're better, but they're not fine.
What's the greatest, Dr. Brown, from your perspective, having lived it, what's the greatest misperception that people have about?
The greatest misperception is, and John hit it, but I'm going to dunk it. The greatest misperception is that we got our freedom. We now have equality. And that it was a movement. It was a movement that included people of all colors. Social justice, equality is a continual movement. And it ceased to be a movement because we thought we had arrived. That was the biggest sham in the world. A movement has to continue. It has to continue. Justice has to continue. You're constantly having to be an agitator. Agitate for justice, agitate for equality. Look at the the chasm that's broadened between the haves and the have-nots. We thought we had arrived. Stock market can crash. And that's the same thing about the movement for freedom. It's a continuum. We've got the immigration issue now. We got these children. We still got, we have thought, and particularly in the black experience, we thought we had arrived. In the white experience, they're saying, you got your freedom now. It's a continuum.
Then you've mentioned Dr. King, and actually several of the callers have too. He's one of those characters now where it's almost like he's denied his humanity in retrospect because, you know, he's become the equivalent of a human statue, you know, unblemished. You knew the man, and you knew him young, too. Yeah. You knew him, I mean, you were talking at the top of the show about the fact that when he first started coming to your father's house, he was 25, 26 years old. I mean, he was what, 26 when the Montgomery bus boycott started. Tell me something about him that lets me know what kind of human being he was. Not what a great leader he was, not what, you know, something he did that was embarrassing or very human that people could relate to.
Oh, Dr. King was, he was regular. I'm not realizing what you were saying when I'd see them come to the house. You know, he smoked Winston cigarettes. In my experience, in our culture, then they come there and tell lies. That is, we're telling jokes. They would joke, and they had their cocktails and everything, and they would call my mother red because my mother was very fair-skinned. She looked white, and when she get mad, she turned red. So they call Mother Red. Well, she's half Irish, so that was it. And they called her Red. Red, what you got going on? She would leave the house. I'd get the car. See, when they were there, I could get the car. I could drive and stay out all night because they going to stay up and have a good time, tell lies, as we say. He was tough in shooting in pool. He was mean in pool. And they told a lot of jokes. But it was like when he'd walk out that door, which I use the same scenario, when he'd walk out that door and hit the public, it was showtime. I can't relax at all. Now, you're talking about tense. It was always, but he had a way of calming himself. His studies of India and Gandhi helped him a whole lot. And I went to his school in the graduate level, Crozier, where he had studied. Mm-hmm. And I did my graduate study under two of his professors. And I got an idea of what helped mold him and shape him when I was at Crozier, where he went. So it was a mixture of his own spirituality along with his human capacity to be able to laugh, smile, and joke. I don't ever remember seeing him ever being angry, but I have seen him feeling hurt. Mm-hmm. I saw that.
How would he manifest when he was feeling hurt?
Them were the cryingest characters I ever saw in my life. Him, Ralph, and all of them, they get to crying and bawling, and I just want to get out.
Oh.
No, they had a lot. Yeah, they would shed tears. They would cry.
We are talking about Freedom Summer on its 50th anniversary here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, John, we were talking during the break about how, you know, after Freedom Summer, one of the other things is that a lot of the schisms in the, you know, in the civil rights movement began to manifest themselves. That, you know, we're talking about two years down the line, Stokely Carmichael's talking about black power and all of that. Can you talk about what the pressures were that led to some of those breaks and that tension?
Yeah. First of all, I think there is a misconception that you had the civil rights movement and then you had black power. I mean, they were both going on at the same time. Mm-hmm. The whole voting rights campaign in Mississippi was about black power because blacks in the Mississippi Delta were a majority. So when Stokely shouted black power in the Mississippi Delta, they didn't take it necessarily as anti-white. That's what they were about.
Mm-hmm.
But the tensions, what was happening at Atlantic City when it appeared that the Liberal Democratic Party had turned their back on the Freedom Democrats, that progress was slow. People have been getting beaten up for years. Stokely himself said in Greenwood, he said, I've been beaten, I've been in jail, and I ain't going to jail no more. And so people began to withdraw. Bob Moses, who was one of the great mm-hmm. men, the great leaders of the movement, began to talk in black nationalist terms. We'll have our own schools. We'll have our own government. There was a real frustration at the lack of progress among these blacks who had been working all this time, while whites, on the other hand, are saying, what more do you want? We passed all these laws.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Brown, I'll say, were there times, you personally, that you thought, this is a waste of time? You know, we're not going to be able to move this thing. We are just not going to be able to do it. We're just going to, you know, get hurt or get killed in the process. Did you ever despair?
No. You couldn't. No. Just that's just a plain no. The with John bringing up the Black Power movement. See, I was also over in Lowndes County, and when he brought that up, the Black Panther Party mm-hmm. came out of the fact 87% of the people in that county were black voters, mm-hmm. and we wanted to get them registered. No, along with the what you just presented, there was joy in success. Mm-hmm. Every time we got a registered voter, every time we had 20 more votes, hey, that was victory. Even though we getting our behinds kicked, mm-hmm. but it's always victory when we had more voters and when we watched the faces of the people feeling like, hey, we're achieving. When we're in the freedom schools working with the children and they're learning, that was struggle. That was sacrifice. And you get a joy out of sacrificing. The movement taught me one thing very important. It was that my life had to be portrayed as a sacrifice, not what I'm going to get, but what I can give. And at the same time, can my giving enrich somebody else to be givers? And Bob Moses had the best statement. He said, we are out to do this job. Organize organizers.
Okay. Now, what did you hope, personally, what did you hope to accomplish out of your service? What did you hope would be the end result?
The end result is a continued struggle of equality. And at the same time, when I got out of the movement and went into another aspect of the movement, they called me the Pied Piper because in 1968-69, I recruited close to 25,000 students to go to colleges, of the black colleges, based on all of the various students and families I knew in the South, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Arkansas. And I recruited students to get in college and get your degrees. That's what I hope to accomplish and still try to accomplish by educating. Wait. Now, the biggest mistake was I pastored for 33 years and missed out all the other things I wanted to do. That was the biggest mistake.
What things did you want to do that you missed out
on? I really wanted to get overseas and do more work overseas in India and South Africa and educate. But I stayed here and did something that the people would say, you guided by the Spirit, and I pastored mm-hmm. And taught at Martin University. And still do radio.
When we're talking about the Freedom Summer and we talk about sort of its impact and the kind of long shadow, you know, it exerts in terms of shadow in a positive sense, the influence of it, there also was this feeling that part of the reason that things changed after that is that the goals that, you know, the immediate goal of voter registration, the political ones, were both easier to measure the success than the other, the socioeconomic and the cultural ones that were going to follow, and that there really wasn't a consensus among people who were working toward those goals about how to get at them. Is that a fair assessment, John?
Well, yeah. I think that there were, that when you're sitting in at a lunch counter, mm-hmm. when you are going down to the courthouse knowing that you might get beaten up or you're going to lose your job if you try to register, those are concrete things. Once the laws were passed, it became more difficult. You know, what do you do with economic discrimination? What do you do with institutional discrimination? And there were different ways of going about that. But I think, you know, to come back to Mississippi, for example, where all this started, mm-hmm. that you had blacks voting in large numbers by the late 1960s. You have more black elected officials in Mississippi than in any other state. The Jim Crow signs began to come down. The black middle class made substantial gains throughout all of this. But I think one of the major accomplishments of the movement in Mississippi was the beginning of the end of the Reign of Terror directed against black people. And this could both be from individual whites and from the institutions, the police, the law enforcement agencies. So there have been very positive changes here, and blacks now have the right to organize their own communities. And, of course, this is seen as a threat by many of the whites in the South who are passing laws to make it more and more difficult for minorities to get to the polls. But that's a whole other program.
Dr. Brown, how often do you think of those days now, of Freedom Summer?
I guess I'm fortunate. A lot of people ask me comments, and now they're pushing me, say, why don't you write the book? And I've been trying to figure out what the title would be, but they said, why don't you write the memoirs of the movement? It's live in front of me because I'm looking at young people that I feel, I see families that don't have a clue.
Yeah.
I see a movement having to start all over again. That's what I see.
What is the most powerful memory you have of that time? You know, the one that can just rock you right down to your heels when you think about it.
The most powerful one would be the Selma initiatives that took place two or three times. There were initiatives that took place two or three times, not just the bridge, the Selma initiative, and then the Mississippi Summer Project. Really, that was the powerful moment, having thousands of young people, and we down there in Oxford, Ohio, at Miami College, and they were coming in by the, what we say, by the boatloads. They were in there. That was a powerful moment of unity for a battle, and then the battle was in Selma that I witnessed three times.
And in a sentence or so, what would you tell a young person who really wants to affect powerful change in the world today? What's the lesson?
Learn your history. Educate yourself on your history and the history here in America for social change.
I think that's an appropriate last word here for this program. I'd like to thank both of you. I'd like to thank my guests, Dr. Thomas Brown, who is a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and historian John Dittmer, who's a professor emeritus of history from DePauw and is the author of Local People, The Struggle for Civil Rights in Mississippi. I'd like to thank both of you. I learned an awful lot from listening to you today. Thank you very much.
Enjoyed it immensely.
Certainly. Thank you.
And Dr. Brown, thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you.
I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producer, Cedric Freeman, and board engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.